as expected, the Saskatchewan government has tabled legislation which invokes the notwithstanding clause in order to implement their gender and pronouns policy schools in Saskatchewan. Essentially then, those under 16 would have to have parental consent before they go by a different name or referred to with different pronouns. Now, this was something that was likely to end up being challenged before the courts. And in fact, there was an injunction granted by a judge at the end of September, which paused the government's policy. So Saskatchewan's Premier Scott Moe responded to that by saying he would invoke the notwithstanding clause, which is what they did today.
One of the highest priorities, if not the highest priority of every parent across this province is the well-being of their children. Mr. Speaker, and that's precisely who we have said on the floor of this legislature in the rotunda that this government is listening to as we find our way into this House to pass this piece of legislation that up until now has been a policy that was in place until recently. Mr. Speaker, a policy also that I would say was in place in a number of school divisions, either by policy or by practice across the province, Mr. Speaker. And so most certainly this government is going to ensure that we are doing all we can to support parents, support families, so Mr. Speaker, whether it be with their involvement in their child's education, their child's school, their child's classroom, Mr. Speaker, or supporting those children as well with the mental health and all too often subsequent addictions challenges that we have in many of our communities across Saskatchewan and across Canada.
So there's already been a lot of debate around the policy itself, but now we've got a new layer to that debate, the use of the notwithstanding clause. Is it appropriate to use here? Is it appropriate to use ever? Section 33 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms outlines the notwithstanding clause, so it is a part of the Charter, but should it be there? There's a new paper out from the Donald Laurier Institute called When Rights Clash, the Notwithstanding Clause in Saskatchewan's Pronoun Policy. It makes the argument that this is the kind of situation the clause was designed for, that it's entirely legitimate for legislatures to make use of it. Joining us to talk more about it is the author of this piece, Dave Snow, an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Guelph. Professor Snow, great to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Let's start with kind of the overview and what people need to know about Section 33 of the Charter, the Notwithstanding Clause. I think Canadians largely have a kind of a general understanding of what it is, but what do people need to know about it, first of all?
Well, I think the first and most important thing that Canadians need to know is that it is part of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms itself. It's Section 33 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and it permits legislatures to declare that an act or a portion of an act will operate notwithstanding certain charter provisions for a period of up to 5 years. And then after that, that can be reenacted. So the two most important features of the notwithstanding clause that I think often get lost is first and foremost that it is a legislative, not an executive instrument. That is to say, it's that the premier cannot simply say, I'm invoking the notwithstanding clause and it is invoked, but that it needs to be incorporated as part of a bill and go through the normal hurly-burly of legislative debate. And the second thing is that while it is the language of the notwithstanding clause, the language of the charter says that it shall operate notwithstanding certain provisions in the charter. The charter itself is written in very, very broad language, and all rights are subject to reasonable limits. So 41 years after the Charter of Rights and Freedoms has come into being in Canada, what it really means to invoke the notwithstanding clause for a legislature is not to say, most of the time, we disagree with these rights per se,
right,
but we disagree with the judicial interpretation of these rights as has occurred primarily by the Supreme Court of Canada over the last 40 years, or we disagree with the expected judicial interpretation of rights based on Supreme Court jurisprudence.
Right. And it's also worth noting, I mean, it is limited in its application. So it's about certain sections of the charter, rulings that might fall under certain sections of the charter.
Yeah, so it is only limited to certain sections of the charter. Those sections do contain what I think most people would refer to as most of our most important rights. So
okay,
the fundamental freedoms in Section 2, your right to freedom of expression, freedom of religion, etc. Your legal rights in Section 7 to 14, which includes the right to life, liberty, security of the person, and the right to equality in Section 15. So its scope is limited in terms of rights. It can't be applied to the right to vote, for example. But beyond the right to vote, I think most would agree that the sections to which it can apply are very important. important sections and very important rights in the Charter.
Yeah, I think we people might be more familiar with Quebec's usage of the notwithstanding clause dealing with language rights or even religious freedom. This issue in Saskatchewan is I guess a little bit different, but some of the same principles. And it's also worth noting, I mean, your piece isn't about the Saskatchewan policy per se, but it is kind of the jumping off point for this conversation. So where do the merits or the lack thereof, I guess, as people would see it, of this policy, how does that factor into this debate as you see it?
I'm happy to chat with the sort of caveat that I'm by no means an expert in either Saskatchewan politics. I live in Ontario, or on the sort of gender pronoun in schools issue. My background is, you know, studying the courts and law and boring notwithstanding clause things. Mm-hmm. But what struck me about this issue and what sort of led to the idea of writing the paper for the MacDonald Laurier Institute that I wrote was that this is a classic example of a policy where both sides are really using the language of rights. So obviously parental rights on the government side, I believe that the legislation, which I haven't yet read, that's going to be introduced today, is called the Parental Bill of Rights. And then my paper sort of goes through the myriad scope of different rights claims that the other side is using, LGBTQ rights, children's rights, rights to privacy, all sorts of different rights. And so what scholars of the Charter have been saying for the last four decades is that this is what the Charter does. It encourages us to think about contested, really difficult, really intractable policy issues in the language of rights. And the problem with thinking about things in the language of rights is that you don't compromise on rights, right? If something's my right, I don't think of it as having a limit. I don't say, yes, it's my right, but I ought to allow some variation here. And so it does really make for a sort of messy and polarized policy debate. And so this particular issue is one, more than any that I've seen for quite some time, where both sides are really using the language of rights. And both sides are really using the language of rights without like a clear section of the Charter or even a clear Supreme Court jurisprudence, sort of a clear case that would obviously apply to this particular policy issue. And that's what I find so fascinating about this issue and the use of the notwithstanding clause in it.
I guess it's also worth noting here that, I mean, there hasn't been a court ruling that struck down this law in Saskatchewan. There was an injunction that kind of ordered the government to take some more time to study all of this. But the point's been made about the preemptive use of the notwithstanding clause. But is that a meaningless distinction or is that a relevant factor here?
I don't know if meaningless. I don't know if I'd go that far, but I have written before that I think that the use of the sort of preemptive versus responsive distinction is overdone. And I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but even if you don't count the 3 years from 1982 to 1985, where Quebec invoked the notwithstanding clause for every single law that it passed as a sort of way of protesting the creation of the new constitution without its consent, mm-hmm. Even if you don't count those, and those are obviously preemptive, that the I think it's 82% of the time that a legislature has invoked the notwithstanding clause in a bill that was passed, it wasn't reacting to a specific charter decision, whether from the Supreme Court or another level of court. So preemptive use of the notwithstanding clause is nothing new. It's the norm. It's something that the creators of the charter fully understood would happen. And it's something that the Supreme Court said in 1988, it fully expected to happen. Now, with respect to the Saskatchewan case in particular, I guess I'd say two things. One, this injunction really shows the sort of messiness of the preemptive and reactive distinction in that there was a court ruling, right? So is the government reacting to the court ruling? I would say, yes, it's literally reacting. It announced its decision the same day as mm-hmm. the injunction, but it's not reacting to a specific striking down of a specific policy. So I grant that. But the other aspect is that if you read the injunction closely, I think it's fairly clear that this particular justice, Justice McGaugh, whose injunction I thought was sort of, very well laid out, understood and written in understandable language, his discussion of the various points brought up by both sides, I would be very surprised if Justice McGaugh were to then subsequently in the full charter case uphold the policy as a reasonable limit on charter rights. So I'm not saying that the government read the case closely and then decided to introduce a law invoking the notwithstanding clause. Just given the short time period, it probably didn't. But I do think that this constant refrain that you'll hear from critics of the notwithstanding clause, that you should only wait until a judge fully rules on the issue. And then sometimes people will say, and then it needs to be appealed all the way to the Supreme Court. That really hamstrings legislatures and I think goes against the original intention of the notwithstanding clause, which is to allow legislatures to disagree with judicial interpretation of rights, including sort of longstanding judicial interpretations.
Now, a couple of points then. I mean, I guess one, and this is almost political in a way, but it speaks to the fact that we have the charter in the first place, that, you know, it probably wouldn't have been agreed upon had there not been Section 33. In that context, if we sort of look at, you know, the existence of the charter, the inclusion of the notwithstanding clause, is it possible to have one without the other?
Yeah, I do think it's very true that at least in the early 1980s, that the premiers were not going to sign on, two premiers in particular, an NDP premier from Saskatchewan and a Progressive Conservative premier from Alberta, really said, you know, we need this inclusion of the notwithstanding clause in this document. There's sort of all sorts of history as to why that was necessary. There was a reasonable limit section that got watered down, but it was an important and necessary compromise that led to the creation of the charter itself. Now, having said that, there are, again, many critics of the notwithstanding clause who, I think I saw the term in the Globe and Mail recently, referred to it as a grubby last-minute compromise. And actually looking at the historical evidence, the documentation, the memoirs of the premiers and the political officials who were involved, this was not something grubby. It was not something last minute. It was debated for several years. It sort of drew from language from the 1960 Bill of Rights and was something that, you know, these premiers of various different political persuasions had very good reasons to be to want to be able to have a safety valve, if you were, to be able to legislate on areas that they were worried the judiciary would go beyond. And it's not sort of your simple sort of a socially progressive judiciary today, and you've got conservative premiers who want to push back. That has seemed to be the most common use of the notwithstanding clause recently. But for example, Saskatchewan Premier Alan Blakeney was really concerned that a future court, as the Supreme Court almost did in 2005, would strike down bans on private health insurance, which he saw as sort of instrumental to the maintenance of Saskatchewan and Canada's public health care system. So the idea of there are certain rights, there are certain values, there are certain policies that are not protected by the charter, and we want to ensure that some future judiciary will not be able to put those policies sort of beyond the realm of legislative authority. That was a really, you know, deep aspect of political thought that led to the inclusion of the clause in the charter.
Right. And I think that, you know, the other side of that argument, though, is that it's not so much a safety valve as it, you know, it's an out clause, that we have the charter that exists to put parameters around the kind of legislation that governments can exist, to say it must exist within these confines of protecting rights. And then we have Section 33 that just kind of renders all of that moot if governments so choose. So what about that argument that it contradicts the very nature or point of having constitutionally guaranteed rights?
Well, I think that I do think that is an argument that is common and worth engaging with. But I think the very first section of the charter says, you know, these rights are subject to reasonable limits, demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. So even without the notwithstanding clause, we have a constitutional document that recognizes our charter is all of the rights within it are subject to reasonable limits. Mm-hmm. Now, those limits tend to be determined by courts and by the Supreme Court of Canada. But the fact that these rights themselves have limits shows that it is, you know, not beyond the pale for someone to say, I'm going to disagree with this particular judicial interpretation of rights. And I think that, you know, we could go through the lists of the notwithstanding clause and I could say, here are the policies I like and here are the policies I don't like. But I certainly think, even looking at I think it is now 8 bills that have been introduced in the last 5 years by 4 different provincial governments invoking the clause, these are not, you know, taking away the right to vote, taking away your right to protest government policy, what we think of as sort of our most foundational rights. And that is not to diminish either side of the debate in the gender pronoun policy, but they are typically, even in the uses that I myself am not fond of, they're involving reasonable disagreement, different interpretations of rights, different ways of weighing different rights. And so given the extent to which the Charter has been interpreted in many instances on many policy issues, well beyond what anyone expected, as one might expect 40 years down the line, we weren't thinking of everything back in 1982 that could possibly come in the future, that it is reasonable to say when we are invoking the notwithstanding clause, when a legislature invokes the notwithstanding clause to disagree with judicial interpretation of rights, it is not saying we don't care about any of these rights in the Charter. And I do think the relative infrequency of the clause being invoked speaks to that. It's not, we have not seen the Ontario government, the Saskatchewan government, insert the notwithstanding clause into every single bill or anything like that. It is still quite infrequently invoked.
Well, the papers online, as mentioned, mcdonnelllaurier.ca, and this debate I'm sure will continue, but we certainly appreciate your insight and perspective on all this. Dave, thanks so much for joining us here this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, there you go. Dave Snow, University of Guelph, associate professor of political science. This piece for the MacDonald Laurier Institute. You can find it at MacDonaldLaurier.ca. So I think it ramps up the stakes of this debate. Like when governments use the notwithstanding clause, it does come across as an admission that, yeah, what we're doing violates rights or violates the Charter, but we're going to do it anyway. And if that's how it's going to come across and you feel like what they're doing here, or you feel what Quebec has done has been unfair to religious minorities or language minorities, then it does ramp up the emotion in the debate. It's a bit of a moot point in a way, though, I would argue, because what are we supposed to do? It's part of the Charter. If we want to eliminate the notwithstanding clause, well, that means changing the Constitution. And that's a whole other can of worms. So would it ever be realistic that we could get to that level, that bar that has to be cleared to change the Constitution only for this? I don't think so. Off the top in this hour, though, an issue that Canadians have been talking a lot about as of late, the issue of housing. And the Prime Minister, in fact, was in Yellowknife making a housing announcement. And we've seen a lot of those, but it feels like we're just kind of tinkering on the edges here. And we're not really addressing the fundamental problem. And it's now a big one, where supply and demand are completely out of balance. And so it's no surprise that we've seen housing costs significantly escalate. So a new report out today from the Fraser Institute quantifying that gap. And it's easy enough, I suppose, to look at Canada's population, how much we're adding to the population each year, and how many homes we're building. We've got the people, we don't have the houses. Our population grows, our housing stock is not keeping up. So that gap is continuing to expand. And in fact, it's now at its highest point in the past 50 years. So that's a big problem, and not one that's going to be easily fixed. Joining us to talk more about this report, very pleased to welcome to the program here this afternoon, its author, Joseph Filipowicz, is a senior fellow at the Fraser Institute, fraserinstitute.org. Joseph, great to have you with us here today. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So first of all, let's talk about what it is you're measuring here. And I guess this is straightforward enough that it's we can look at how fast Canada's population is growing. We can look at how many homes we're building each year. So it's kind of a straight comparison between the two.
Yes, exactly. What we did was we compared annual population growth, so the change in the number of people living in Canada every year, with the number of homes completed every year, so the amount of homes we built. And what we found is that the gap between demand and supply is not just bad. It's not just worsening with every single year. It's growing at a pace that we've not seen before. So last year, Canada's population grew by about 1 million people, but we only built about 220,000 homes. Wow. So that gap is historical.
Yeah, that's a pretty huge gap. So we can look at these trends then, and we can go back over previous periods of time. Like, how do we compare now to where we were at, 5 years ago or 10 years ago or even further back?
So between 2018 and 2022, which is the last 5 years of data, the population grew by an average of about 553,000 people per year. while only about 205,000 homes were built annually. So that's a ratio of about 2.5 to 1. But back in the 1970s, it was closer to 1 to 1. In fact, we not only built more than 200,000 homes a year in the 1970s, but our population growth was roughly in the 300,000 range, quite a bit lower. So a lot closer to 1 to 1 then than is the case now. So I think it's just jarring that we build the same or actually in some cases, some years, less housing than we did in the 1970s now, even though our population is about a third bigger than it was then.
Yeah, that's pretty shocking. So how did it get that way? I mean, you know, there are two sides to this. The population growth is a little more, I guess, straightforward. And part of that is policy choice in terms of, you know, how many newcomers Canada welcomes each year. But I guess the question about why we're only building a certain number of houses each year, that's a little more complicated, I would imagine.
Well, absolutely. This is a multifaceted crisis, and Canadians are right to demand solutions to it, right? All governments have policy levers that affect both the demand for housing and also the supply of housing. On the ground, municipalities determine the kinds of homes that we have and how many of them are allowed to be built. But then you also have the federal government that's primarily responsible for population growth, notably through immigration policy. And it's not very often that these two levels of government, you know, coordinate on these matters. So what we're seeing now is really, you know, a weak point in our federation that's really coming to a head these days.
And I mean, it's not as though we just woke up to this situation. I mean, it's as bad as it's ever been, obviously, but it does seem as though we were headed in this direction. Like it, in hindsight, I guess, maybe we would have been better off trying to address this crisis 5 or 10 years ago than wait until now.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, unfortunately, things, you know, really have to get bad for. I mean, the fact that the federal government is now talking about this issue, despite the fact they don't have the strongest levers when it comes to housing supply, the fact that it's become their problem, I think is a testament to how bad things have gotten. Right? This is not a local issue that's manifesting itself in certain years and in certain cities like say Toronto or Vancouver. This is a national problem. And unfortunately, it had to get to this stage for all three levels of government to start talking about it. So now the next step is they have to coordinate to get more homes built or to just, you know, manage this gap between supply and demand.
Well, that's the big issue. I mean, it's basic economics, but, you know, it's hard to get affordability when we've got supply and demand so out of balance. And I know governments are trying to tweak all of this with various policies, but I guess unless we can address that fundamental imbalance, we're really not going to get these prices under control, are we?
No, absolutely not. I mean, every new policy that's introduced, because of course there's impetus now to introduce new policies. It's really important to ask of each proposal, does it restrict supply? Does it juice demand? Because if it does either of those things, it's not going to solve our problem. In fact, it's going to make things worse.
Are you seeing any signs that we're turning a corner here, that policymakers are waking up to this crisis? Like, has there been any sea change here in terms of actually seriously trying to address this?
Well, I certainly think that at least on the communications front, we're seeing a lot more. And you know, in fairness, we are seeing a lot more policy activity. There's been a flurry of activity, especially at the provincial level in Ontario, and it looks like that's going to be the case in BC soon. But you know, governments are starting with a real lag. The problem is enormous, and you know, it's getting worse. That's what the data are showing. So unfortunately, it's certainly good that more attention is being brought to this problem. But I think that we're still in the tinkering mode when what's really needed is a big bang when it comes to policy solutions.
Well, and we have the two sides of it. And I mean, you know, reducing demand is never ideal. I suppose higher prices or higher mortgage rates, you know, kind of have that effect. But ultimately, we do get into the realm of policy decisions around immigration, and that can be sensitive. And I mean, you know, there's the whole point that Canada is going to need immigration in years ahead to try to keep productivity levels where they need to be. So can we address the demand side? Does it inevitably have to land on the supply side and figuring out how to add more supply, or how do we address this?
Well, I think, you know, at its root, this this gap is caused by governments not communicating. We're now in a situation where the federal government has the most direct control over housing demand, while provinces and municipalities have the most direct control over housing supply. And, yeah. and unfortunately, they don't coordinate. So I think whatever, you know, whatever approach is taken, there needs to be coordination, because, you know, if there's going to be changes to, you know, for example, not just immigration, but like home building policies, all the, like the plans, the long-term plans that provinces and local governments put together to get homes built, they're going to have to take into account long-term growth. And on the federal government side, they're going to have to make these numbers predictable, because we've seen huge increases in the last 5-6 years. And there's no way that these increases are reflected in local government's plans. So I think it's essential that whatever option is taken, all governments need to be on board and aware of what each other are doing, because otherwise they're just going to be at cross purposes.
Right. And I mean, you know, as much as this is or should be a wake-up call, as much as we're seeing more conversation around these issues, you know, there's no guarantee that things are going to improve, right? Is there still a possibility, as bad as this gap is right now, as wide as it is, that it could still worsen in the years ahead?
It's really hard to see, you know, how this is going to play out. It's just jarring that we have kind of the record gap that we have today. So perhaps 2 years ago, we would have already been, you know, in a situation where there's an enormous gap between demand and supply. And could we have foreseen it getting larger? Not, I don't think so. So I mean, I can say today that I don't see it getting any larger, but I could easily be proven wrong.
Well, let's hope for the best as we move forward here. But as mentioned, should be a wake-up call. Some important new data. It's called Canada's Growing Housing Gap at FraserInstitute.org. Joseph, thanks so much for making some time for us here today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on the show, Rob.
Okay, there you go. Joseph Filipowicz, Senior Fellow with the Fraser Institute, author of this report, which you can read, as mentioned, FraserInstitute.org. But yeah, and it's pretty bleak. So, yeah, let's certainly hope that, you know, we don't somehow manage to back ourselves into an even bleaker situation 5 years from now. But I don't know. We got ourselves into this situation, so it's hard to find optimism these days on this issue for sure. New report out today from the Clean Prosperity Institute, looking at how Alberta can be a player. An important player in a decarbonizing world. And the assumption maybe going into this is that Alberta is an oil and gas economy, a fossil fuel economy, and that we're going to be left behind when it comes to a decarbonizing world. But this report says that's not the case. That yes, there's certainly a lot of competition when it comes for that sort of investment. But I think already, as we've seen, Alberta has attracted its share and then some of investment into cleaner energy. So this report from the Clean Prosperity Institute looks at how Alberta can continue to close that gap with other jurisdictions, and how Alberta can be a real balanced energy superpower. So joining us to talk more about this report, which you can find at cleanprosperity.ca, very pleased to welcome the program here this afternoon, the report's co-author, Adam Sweet, who is Western Canada Director for Clean Prosperity. Adam, great to have you with us here today. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Rob. Great to be back.
So let's talk about the backdrop to all of this, where Alberta's at, where, you know, in particular, the United States is at, but other jurisdictions when it comes to, you know, this emerging alternative energy industry.
Yeah, so the global race for low carbon investment is on. The nice thing for Alberta is that we have everything that we need, almost everything we need to compete in this environment and to truly become a diversified energy powerhouse. One thing I do want to add on that is it's not just about, you know, low carbon energy, but it's also about how do we continue to ensure that our existing oil and gas assets are being used, are able to meet that demand that exists in the world, and be used to transform into these new forms of energy, such as, you know, hydrogen, blue ammonia, these sorts of things. Now, while that race is on and Alberta is well positioned, we have some competitors who've really taken some big steps. You know, the U.S. has their Inflation Reduction Act, in which they are essentially buying first-class tickets for any investor who wants to do this sort of investment. We also have Saudi Arabia, for example, really moving quickly on hydrogen. And so there's a situation in which Alberta's positioned, and we can win this race, but we have some key moves that we need to make, and we need to make them right away.
So is it primarily the U.S. that we're in a race with, or, you know, who are the other players or competitors here?
Yeah, our research really focused on the U.S., given that many of these markets are connected when we're looking at this space. There are certainly other, when we talk about the global aspect of this, that is a piece that we have to be concerned, because once those projects are established and those purchase orders are made, it becomes much more challenging to argue to create, you know, these new capital projects in Alberta. So we're in a space right now where we want to get these projects established in Alberta to be able to meet that demand that's growing. And the U.S. is our main competitor. You know, what they've done with the Inflation Reduction Act is essentially said we are going to give a production tax credit to investors in particular key areas. So, for example, carbon capture and storage or in hydrogen development. And they said, well, if you come in, you set up your plant here or you make this investment here in the U.S., we will give you a guaranteed, or what we're calling a bankable amount of money that you can take to a financer and put into your project's business plan. What's happened in Alberta, unfortunately, is we don't have necessarily that certainty. Instead, we have the tier carbon credit market. And what we are arguing is, you know, in order to compete, Alberta doesn't need to come to the table with billions of dollars and try to compete with the U.S. Treasury. Instead, what we can do is bring certainty around future revenues in that carbon credit market that we've had since 2007. And that actually creates a certainty for investors to know that their project will generate the revenues they need. And therefore, we can compete with the United States without having to bring billions of dollars to bear.
Yeah, because I think some think or fear that this is a subsidies arms race. But that's not the path you're advocating here. In fact, that in many ways, this is an argument against big subsidies.
It is. You know, in some ways, it's almost like, do you remember the Amazon second headquarters race?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
It was, you know... There's, you know, the United States has decided to say, we're just going to throw money at this big problem and see kind of what we can attract. You know, that's never been a really efficient approach, and that's not one we would advocate for. I'd also say it's, you know, not an Albertan approach to just throw money at it. Instead, it's actually how do we come together and create a plan and figure out, you know, how do we move this path forward? What we're advocating for is a thing called a carbon contract for difference. And what that would do is create certainty in what's called the tier carbon credit market, which again has existed since 2007 in Alberta, and it would allow investors to go to financiers in the bank and say, look, we have what's called a contract for difference that'll guarantee us that we will have a certain set of revenue when we sell these credits, and that we can actually bank on that moving forward. And so what we're advocating for is to say Alberta can create certainty in the market, and that actually meets creates an advantage for investors over setting up in the United States in areas like blue ammonia or in cement, or sorry, carbon capture and storage on cement, or, you know, as we've talked a lot, there's a big discussion right now around natural gas-fired electricity. If we can create certainty through this carbon contract for difference, we could actually create an advantage for investors to set up in Alberta over the United States and not have to bring billions of dollars to bear.
Let's talk about the TIER, the Technology, Innovation, and Emissions Reduction Regulation that Alberta's had, I think going back as far as 2007. So this is Alberta's carbon pricing system then, correct?
That's correct.
So how would then these credits and these contracts be tied into those regulations?
So currently, emitters pay into the TIER fund,
right,
for certain amounts, and not to go too technical on it, but they put a piece into that, and there's credits that are traded if they can't meet their emissions standards, and so those credits have a value in them, they have a value in them. And so what a carbon contract for difference would do would be between, you know, the government either an emitter or somebody who's creating carbon credits by having a low carbon project. And they would say, look, so we think we know the industrial carbon price is going to be $170 a ton in 2030. We expect that the credit will trade for $150, let's say, And so this would be the contract people would have to figure this all out. But let's say it's going to trade for about $150 in 2030 because the credit would trade for less than the price. And the government does an agreement with the producer and says, look, if it's $151, you owe us a dollar per ton. If it's $149, we owe you a dollar per ton. And if it's within the range of $150, then the contract just becomes null and void and it expires. But you have this guaranteed revenue going forward. The way we can describe it is it's like Mother Nature taking out crop insurance. Now, the government can control the general market by how many credits are needed by emission standards and various things. But what this does is create certainty for that low carbon producer to know that they can go back to a financer or to an investor and say, look, we know we'll have this guaranteed revenue, you know, from now until 2030 or further out. So, you know, we can invest in the project. And from a government perspective, the government doesn't actually have to put any money out into it unless the credit price is lower than it would need to be. But the government can help to influence what that credit price is going to be by the emissions standards that they set. Mm-hmm. So that's where the government can kind of control whether or not they're actually going to be paying out in this space, but it creates certainty for investors. And at the end of the day, should actually cost incredibly minimally just basically the execution of the development of the contract itself.
So you see that then as, well, I guess much less risky, but more efficient than more direct subsidies.
100%. It's also, I would argue, a more of a free market approach. You know, this is not about government giving out handouts. It's not about government providing incentives that are, you know, cash based. This is instead saying, look, we've created an even playing field for everybody to be in here, but we know that there's a lot of questions about the industrial carbon price. There's a lot of questions about the future. So we are going to engage in agreement with you, you know, energy investor, and say, look, we commit that we're not going to change things in this particular period of time. We're not going to influence this market negatively in this period of time. You can go and get financing and develop your project. And by the way, you'll actually make more money doing it here in Alberta than you will in the United States. And we can do that in a way that's not actually costing taxpayers money like they're doing in the United States or in other places around the world.
So can Alberta do this more or less on its own, or does this require a role for the federal government?
So the federal government announced in the most recent budget that they were going to do some consultations around carbon contracts for difference. Our view is that they were supposed to launch those consultations. They're still kind of being held up. So we're actually going to have a webinar here next week. People can take a look on cleanprosperity.ca and see more details on that, where we're going to talk about the consultations and essentially what industry and interested people can do. But our main push is to say that, you know, if we can do it from the federal government with kind of a broad-based approach as opposed to, you know, specific province by province, that would be the most efficient way to do it. Also, if you create that project from a federal perspective, it just makes it more it'll be more standardized across the country. We are advocating for the province to work with the feds and to say, look, we need to push this forward. This is important. We know that there are a number of projects in Alberta that are ready to go tomorrow if they could get certainty through a carbon contract for difference. So we're calling on the provincial government to work with the federal government and advance these contracts for difference. And if they can't, or if that's not going to be possible, to then look to implement a provincial program itself, which could be, you know, backstop using the tier revenue, for example.
But back to what we talked about at the outset, Adam, what's the risk of not embracing this opportunity? What's the risk of the status quo or allowing other jurisdictions to pull further ahead of us?
So, you know, when I look at the future of Alberta, I look at it as a place that continues to be a global diversified energy powerhouse. And so while that means that we need to continue to develop our oil and gas resources and get the best price and best access to market for those existing resources, the reality is that we know that there will be a decline in demand for oil and gas, and there's going to be an increase in things like demand for hydrogen, sustainable aviation fuel, and other things such as that. And so we want to ensure, I would like to see a situation in which Alberta is helping to set the price, the global price for those new forms of energy. And, you know, we not just to meet our emissions reduction, but actually to be able to be market leaders in this space. not just for revenue, but also for, you know, we have some of the best talent in the world in these sectors. And I'd like to see Alberta be able to lead the way in the development of that technology and be able to, you know, sell our expertise around the world and help the rest of the world develop these technologies as well.
Much more is mentioned, cleanprosperity.ca. Adam, thanks so much for making some time for us here this afternoon. Appreciate it.
Thanks for the opportunity. Have a great day.
You too. There you go. That is Adam Sweet, Clean Prosperity's Western Canada Director, based in Edmonton, the co-author of this report, calling on the Alberta government to take what it already has with the TIER regulations and use that as the starting point for carbon contracts and credits, which they say is a much less risky and a much more efficient way of encouraging this kind of investment and innovation.
I wanted him to feel safe and that it was a great place for him to live.
Did you ever think you would be free?
I hoped.
Hello, Jack. Thanks for saving our little girl.
That from the trailer for the 2015 movie Room, which was based on the 2010 bestseller, also called Room. The film landed its star Brie Larson an Academy Award. The author of the book, who was also the author of the screenplay, was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay. So it's a book that really put Emma Donoghue on the map. But has had a few bestsellers and has a new book out. It's called Learned by Heart. And is among five finalists for the Atwood Gibson Writers Trust Fiction Prize. Emma Donoghue is going to be here in Calgary this weekend, part of WordFest Imaginarium. Two events she'll be part of, one tomorrow night and one on Saturday. More details at wordfest.com. But joining us to talk about her latest book, about everything else going on in her world, and as mentioned, the appearance coming up this weekend here in Calgary, the aforementioned Emma Donoghue. On the line with us here this afternoon. Emma, so great to have you with us. Welcome to the program.
I feel the same way. Nice to be with you.
Let's talk about the new book. It is called Learned by Heart, as mentioned. And so this is interesting from a writer's perspective because this is a fictional tale about someone who actually existed. And we have this diary of Ann Lister who lived back in the 19th century, a story you've been fascinated with for quite some time, as I understand. So how did this all come together?
Yeah, the Ann Lister diary has been described as the longest diary in the English language. It's about 5 million words, and it should have been fully published a long time ago, except the scandalous content basically made publishers afraid of it. So even
right
now, it's only available, you know, in transcriptions online through the library, because she had affairs with many women, and she recorded everything very frankly and eloquently in a secret code she invented, made of Greek letters and numbers. She was a very brilliant polymath. So the Ann Lister diaries are extraordinary, but in a way, I set myself the challenge of writing a kind of a backstory for this kind of, you know, gender defying, rule-breaking superhero. I wanted to write about her when she was 14 at boarding school, because that's when she fell madly in love with the girl who was assigned to her attic room, Eliza Raine, who was a biracial heiress straight from India. So I'm fascinated by the bit that Ann Lister's diary doesn't cover, which is this first love affair, the first time she fell madly in love and just thought, you know, conventions be damned.
Yeah.
I have to follow my heart.
Well, there was something remarkable about this story, as you say, given the time of the period and who she was and who she was kind of trying to be or felt that is, you know, she could be at that time. We think about all these issues in a very modern context and, you know, the struggles of coming out and coming to grips with who you are and living your true self. I mean, what would that have been like in the 19th century?
I think that's what makes the story of Eliza Raine and Ann Lister irresistible to tell for a modern audience, because they can sound remarkably modern when they're mulling over, you know, what it is to be. And, you know, Ann Lister saw herself as being not like other ladies, very much masculine, but said she didn't want to be a man. So she described herself as the connecting link between the sexes, or she kind of joked in her diaries about maybe nature was in an odd mood the day she made me. And then Eliza Raine as this biracial heiress, she was in this really strange position of being like a, you know, a high status posh girl in 19th century England, and yet one of the only brown faces around in the north of England where she was sent to boarding school. So these two outsiders happened to get stuck in an attic room together and fell madly in love. And I think that makes their story a terribly modern one, because these questions of sort of parsing the subtleties of your identity and working out how to survive in a very conformist society, you know, they can really appeal to modern readers, especially as Eliza Rain, as the point of view character, she had a lot of struggles with mental illness. And again, that's something that young people today are just so open and honest about.
Yeah. So how do you approach this then as a novelist and telling a story, which is what you do, but also now there's the historical component. So there's the you know, the research side, and maybe there's almost a burden you carry or a duty you carry here to do right by this historical figure.
I absolutely do feel a duty to do right. You put your finger on it there. I don't know why I give myself this double task. Mostly when I write historical fiction, it's based on real lives, and real lives of totally forgotten or neglected or hard done by people who I feel are relying on me to tell their story honestly and to dig up these lost facts. So I'm not writing about the famous. So it is double work, and how I approached it was slowly. I really first got the idea for this novel about 30 years ago. I've been working on more seriously since about 2015, but, you know, interspersed with my other tasks. But I certainly had to work slowly, because it took a lot of digging to work out even the basic facts about Eliza Rain's life. And she, rather than the more famous Anne Lister, she ended up being the perspective of the novel, because I just found her, she had such an interesting angle on British society, because, you know, because she was, you know, simultaneously moving in these rich circles, but also stigmatized as the illegitimate orphan with an Indian mother. You know, she really saw the kind of social undercurrents. She was aware of things that others wouldn't have noticed. So, yeah, I did a huge amount of research. But then, of course, you have to be willing to throw much of it away and just always look for the tiny little details that really speak to character.
Is it almost surprising that you kind of got here first? Like, you know, this has all been known, this material, if you want to call it that, has all been out there for others to explore, either in this sense or in a straight sort of nonfiction retelling of all of this. Why is there such a void here?
I don't know why she's been so neglected, Eliza Rain. There's been a lot of attention paid to other points in Anne Lister's life. For instance, the wonderful TV show Gentleman Jack is about Anne Lister in her 40s and her last relationship. But of all Anne Lister's women, and I say all because there were about a dozen, I really do think Eliza Rain is the most interesting. So I'm, you know, all those years I was working on the novel, I sort of assumed somebody else would get there first, but they haven't. But, you know, when I write novels based on real people, I always offer a big historical note at the end, because what I'm really trying to do is share my sources. I'm not trying to hog these stories. I'm saying, you know, please, somebody else write about them too. I would love to see Eliza Rain's story explored by other people and from different angles, because, you know, I get a huge amount of help from others when I'm writing my novels, and I feel that I want my novels to be equally useful, you know, to future biographers and dramatists and so on. So I see it as a great big kind of, you know, info swap. And really, this novel is partly crowdsourced, I would say, because there were sources I just couldn't get hold of myself. And volunteers transcribed the letters for me, you know, that bewildering 19th century handwriting. So I actually couldn't have written this novel without the help of people I've never met in person far away.
I mean, the feeling of completing a book or completing a project must be tremendously rewarding, you know, in all cases. But something like this, then, given the, you know, the stakes, given the importance of the topic, given how difficult it proved to be in some ways, what was that finish line like this time?
And this was an even huger relief than usual. Yeah, because the novel was very slow to grow, because so many people helped me, I really had a feeling that I was kind of dragging a long forgotten story into the light, and it's just wonderful now to be able to see its kind of ripples, to see people coming across it and to do public events and you know, engage in a kind of great big international conversation about these hidden lives of the 19th century. So I have to say I don't think I've ever been quite so satisfied by finally getting a novel out there and you know, feeling that it's not just my novel, but it's taking part in a much huger conversation about all the lives of people of color and queers in the past. It's been a great, great moment.
You've written about these topics before, obviously. Has the audience grown? Is there more of a willingness or an appetite even for these kinds of stories? What have you noticed in your own career and, you know, in terms of your own fame and stature, too, especially after Room? I mean, has that given you a little more clout in exploring these topics?
I guess so. And it's hard to tell. I think in my own case, the big difference was since Room, my books get more readers. So more people are just willing to take a chance on whatever strange story I've dug up because perhaps they enjoyed Room. So it certainly helped me. But also, as you say, there's been a big social change. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know the Gentleman Jack TV show, the wonderful British writer Sally Wainwright was trying to make that show for about 20 years and just could not get it funded. And then there was kind of a magical moment when suddenly it was considered like, oh, this could be of wide mainstream interest. And I think we all like to write that are different from our own. People are not just looking for echoes of their own lives or, you know, their own conventions. I think people have a hunger for what's hidden, what's different, what's remarkable. So, yeah, I find it very heartening that there's more and more interest. Yeah, I hope that continues. And I hope the kind of wave of right-wing backlash in the States we've seen with all those book bannings, I really hope that proves to be a temporary phenomenon and that it doesn't manage to stake any claim in Canada. Because I think Canada, as an immigrant, I'm so aware that it's a country that has benefited hugely from diverse immigrants. And, you know, the melting pot of Canada has been such a plus for all of us, you know, from food through to books through to neighbours. And we all benefit from having, you know, fresh elements in the mix.
We talked about Room, and the book, I think, came out in 2010, I believe, and it was 2015 when the movie came out. At what point did you feel like maybe your life had kind of changed? Like this was at a whole different kind of level. Was that kind of obvious to you in real time, or what was that whole process?
Yeah, I think the day I got, you know, it's funny, you might think a long list is not a big deal, but when I got long listed for the Booker Prize, I was suddenly more in demand than I ever had been. So just, and I was in the middle of a family holiday, and I remember trying to do phone interviews on a really bad early cell phone from a grocery store parking lot in France. And it's funny, you know, writers are always longing for more publicity until the day they make it big, and then suddenly they're like, oh no, too much publicity.
Right.
So it's hard to get that perfect level. But yes, Room did make a huge difference to me. And one thing it did was it opened the doors of the film world, because the film world can be really hard to get into. It can seem very mysterious and closed to outsiders. It's full of jargon. So Room basically gave me the chance to get films made. And it's still not always easy. I've only had two made so far. But between Room and The Wonder, I've been able to work with the most astoundingly talented actors and directors and producers. So I've had two really good experiences so far. So, you know, in a writing career that began at about 20, it's wonderful more than three decades on to feel that, you know, fresh opportunities are arising and I'm getting to try new genres and reach new audiences.
Is it more freedom? Is it more pressure? Is it both, maybe?
Both of those, I suppose. But my publishers are great. They've never said write a sequel to Room or write something like Room. I mean, they may hope for it, but no, they don't tell me what to write. And mostly I perceive it as more freedom, actually.
Yeah.
But, you know, the big thing is that I've been able to write full time since I was about 23. So that, to me, is a big luxury. So, you know, Room didn't make any difference there. I was already living my very best life getting to do this stuff full time, you know.
Absolutely. Well, as we mentioned, latest novel is called Learned by Heart. It has been shortlisted, as mentioned as well, for the Atwood Gibson Writers Trust Fiction Prize. And you'll be here in Calgary. Two events coming up later this week. Part of WordFest, ImaginariumWordFest.com. All the details. I think one of those shows is sold out. Some tickets still available for the events on the 14th. Emma, it's been a real pleasure and an honor. Thank you so much for making some time for us here today.
Me too.
There you go. That's best-selling author, award-winning author, Oscar-nominated writer Emma Donoghue. Her latest book, Learned by Heart, and more details at wordfest.com on her two appearances here in Calgary this weekend. Thanks for downloading and listening to the podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcast. You can also find me on Twitter, at Rob Breckenridge, and you can email me, rob@770chqr.com. Talk to you next time.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.